Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
We'll continue to take your phone calls on Anna Nicole Smith next hour. But from New Orleans, Louisiana, where I'm happy to report, ladies and gentlemen, there medians, what would in other cities be called median strips, in New Orleans are much wider and are called, for complicated historical reasons that we'll go into in another time, they're called neutral ground. And I'm pleased to say that this drive over here to the campus of the University of New Orleans, somebody, now, you know, city's not doing real well at managing the recovery, but so much so that there's some thought in some quarters, come time for masking at Carnival, of going as the mayor sitting atop a pile of his pledges. The name of the presentation, of course, would be called Ray Nagin on His Promises. But somebody somewhere has gotten rid of all the dead trees, the trees that died, that were killed by the floodwaters, and has planted new little saplings all along the width of the neutral ground on a street called Elysian Fields. That's right, the French call it Champs-Élysées. So, you know, little signs here and there. Oh, speaking of which, ladies and gentlemen, rarely heard but required this week.
Los Angeles Dog Trainer Corrections for you.
Just essential. You can't help it. Los Angeles Dog Trainer Corrections this week are absolutely essential. An article Saturday in the California section about the sentencing of scientist William French Anderson mentioned lawyer Blair Burke and said Anderson was his client. Burke is a woman. But much, much better than that. A review in Wednesday's calendar section of a PBS documentary about the Supreme Court said there was a justice named Hamburger. There was a chief justice named Warren Burger. Ladies and gentlemen, Los Angeles Dog Trainer corrections for you. Always doing the job, always on top of things. There is a quote that was just uttered Sunday morning on one of the Yak shows that seems to me to be the quote of the week. Senator Mitch McConnell explaining why the Republicans weren't really all that enthusiastic about a vote. Well, sorry, about why the Republicans weren't all that enthusiastic about looking into the sources of the intel, the intelligence. This was apropos of the Inspector General's report saying Doug Feith's office. Yes, it was a Feith-based operation. Doug Feith's office cooked the intelligence that said, oh, yes, Saddam Hussein is in business with al-Qaeda. Mitch McConnell asked why, you know, there didn't seem to be an awful lot of Republican enthusiasm for pursuing this, said, quote, rehashing what happened 4 years ago has a limited usefulness, unquote. And I'm sure, I haven't done the research, I'm sure that's exactly what he said regarding the Whitewater land deal. But ladies and gentlemen, again, back to more weighty matters, like the Anna Nicole Smith phone calls. Next hour, I promise, you know the story of Lisa Nowak, right? That got a lot of airtime this week. The lovesick astronaut who drove from Texas to Florida to allegedly to perpetrate some nuisance on her rival for the affections of a male astronaut. And I think the reason that the story got so much attention is because the one little detail that she drove from Texas to Florida, she had a lot of equipment, stuff, fixins in her car for whatever she planned for her rival. But because she was in such a hurry to get to Florida, all the news stories stressed that she wore diapers on the drive, so she didn't have to stop. She might have had to stop for gas, but not for the... And it just was... It went all the way around the media and the blogosphere and everything as just a sign of wackiness, whereas I heard it as just a harbinger of a marketing campaign to come.
Hey, dude, where are you rushing off to?
Gotta get this very important package across town, pronto. No stops.
Huh. Hope you're wearing your scampers.
When you've got no time to stop,
you can still go.
Breaker, breaker, good buddy. Meet you at the Mesa Junction truck stop.
Oh, that's a nugatory. We're driving straight on through.
You must be packing your scampers.
Scampers aren't for everyone, but if you're on a tight schedule, if you've got to be somewhere yesterday, scampers can carry your load.
Great speech, Senator. Do you need a break?
No, I'll meet my donors right now. Glad I cast my vote for scampers.
Astronaut-proofed scampers. Peace of mind for your hurry-up lifestyle. And you don't even need to ask your doctor. Scampers. When you can't stop, you can go.
Hello, welcome to the show.
Mighty cool to find you on a mighty broad day.
Yes, it is somewhere else. Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, from right beside the big old lake, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And O.J. Simpson is glad that hypothetical book, If I Did It, has been put on history's scrap heap, because he felt it was, quote, too much like an admission of guilt. He says, quote, I wasn't happy with the hypothetical paragraphs, apparently referring to the night of the events in question. Continuing to quote, a ghostwriter wrote the whole thing and I okayed it, but there were a lot of inaccuracies about the case and about how I would have done things. But I figure I'd let it go since I didn't kill anyone, unquote. But he knew how he would have done it if I were a woman, this is how I would enter a room. That's what I immediately thought of. How would you know? How would you know this is an inaccurate way to describe the killings that you didn't do? But he's glad. And I'm glad for him in that very special way. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. This is from the liberal British newspaper, The Guardian. U.S. preparations for an airstrike against Iran are at an advanced stage, in spite of repeated public denials by the Bush administration, according to informed sources in Washington. The present military buildup would allow the U.S. to mount an attack by the spring, but sources said if there was an attack, it was more likely next year, just before President Bush leaves office. Neoconservatives are urging Bush to open a new front against Iran. So, too, is the Vice President, Dick Cheney. Oddly out of character. Sources said Bush had not yet made a decision. The administration insists the buildup is not offensive. It's a matter of opinion, I guess. Vincent Canestraro, a Washington-based intelligence analyst, says planning is going on in spite of public disavowals by Gates. Targets have been selected for a bombing campaign against nuclear sites. It is quite advanced. He adds, we are planning for war. It is incredibly dangerous, unquote. Canestraro worked for the CIA and the National Security Council. He agrees no decision has yet been made. Joshua Marabchik, a Middle East specialist at the American Enterprise Institute, is a vocal supporter of such a strike. I don't think anyone in the U.S. is talking about invasion, he says. We have been chastened by the experience of Iraq. Even a hawk like myself. But an airstrike is another matter. The danger of Iran having a nuclear weapon is not just what it might use it out of the blue, but as a shield to do all sorts of mischief. I do not believe, he says, there will be any way to stop this happening other than physical force. Neoconservative Marabchik. Another neoconservative, Mayrav Wurmser, of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Hudson Institute, is disappointed with the response of the Bush administration so far to Iran, and said if the aim of U.S. policy after 9/11 was to make the Middle East safer for the U.S., it was not working because the administration had stopped at Iraq. Yeah, that's the trouble. We stopped. But one more quote from Marabchik. If it does come to war, says Marabchik, Iran would retaliate, oddly enough. But then on balance, it would be worth it to stop a country that he said had death to America as its official slogan. Quote, we have to gird our loins and prepare to absorb the countershock, unquote. Joshua Marabchik at the American Enterprise Institute. News from the Guardian, from outside the bubble. But there is more from the whole area. From the related newspaper, the Sunday edition of the same publication, The Observer, Iran's efforts to produce highly enriched uranium, the material used to make nuclear bombs, are in chaos. And the country is years from mastering the required technology. Iran's uranium enrichment program is, this is, of course, if you don't enrich uranium, you can't make a weapon. And if the uranium isn't really rich, a former playmate won't want to marry it. Iran's uranium enrichment program has been plagued by constant technical problems, lack of access to outside technology and know-how, and a failure to master the complex production engineering processes involved. A number of Western diplomats and technical experts close to the Iranian program have told The Observer it is archaic, prone to breakdown, and lacks the materials for industrial-scale production. The detailed descriptions of Iran's problems in enriching more than a few grams of uranium using high-speed centrifuges comes in stark contrast to the apocalyptic picture being painted of Iran's imminent acquisition of a nuclear weapon. Instead, say experts, the breakup of the nuclear smuggling organization of the Pakistani scientist Abdul Qadir Khan has massively set back an Iran heavily dependent on his network. Tehran originally procured the extremely high-quality bearings required for the centrifuge's top rotors from foreign companies in Malaysia. That source closed down 2 years ago. Iran is making the bearings itself with only limited success. The repeated failure of these crucial bearings, say sources, has been one of the program's biggest setbacks. I don't know. I'm still scared of them. What about you? There was a story from outside the bubble a couple weeks ago about an Iranian diplomatic initiative in 03 to the United States saying, let's talk it over. Let's put everything on the table. Secretary Rice this week was pressed on whether the Bush administration missed that opportunity to improve relations with Iran back then, when Tehran issued the proposal calling for broad dialogue on matters including cooperation on nuclear safeguards and possible recognition of Israel. Former administration officials have said the proposal was discussed and ultimately rejected by top U.S. officials. Rice, who was then national security advisor, said she never saw the proposal. I think, she said in testimony to a House committee this week, I think I would have noticed if the Iranians had said we're ready to recognize Israel. I just don't remember ever seeing any such thing. Perhaps that wasn't the wording. Rice's comments add a new level of complexity, according to the Washington Post, to an issue that has generated debate among foreign policy experts. Did the administration forego a chance to pursue dialogue with Iran? The Iranian document conveyed to Washington via the Swiss embassy listed a series of Iranian aims for the talks, such as ending sanctions, full access to peaceful nuclear technology, and a recognition of its legitimate security interests. That's from a copy that has circulated in Washington and was verified by both Iranian and U.S. officials. In the document, Iran offered to put a series of U.S. aims on the agenda: full cooperation on nuclear safeguards, decisive action against terrorists, coordination in Iraq, ending material support for Palestinian militias, and accepting a two-state solution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Flint Leverett, who used to work in the administration for the National, Rice's staff in the National Security Council, says he saw the document, the proposal from Iran. Rice said the Iranian offer is now embarrassing and politically difficult for the administration now that it has rejected calls for dialogue. Rice said she didn't know what Flint Leverett was talking about, quite frankly. Maybe I should ask him when he came to me and said we have a proposal from Iran and we really ought to take it. Maybe she should. Leverett made the news recently when he charged in December the White House had orchestrated an effort by the CIA to demand significant deletions in an opinion article he had written on Iran policy, despite the fact that most of the material had appeared publicly before. The claim was the material was classified. The single biggest rescission concerned his description of Iran's 2003 offer. The White House wanted that out of the article. But there's another eye country. In the news, many of the Iraqi forces, whom the U.S. is counting on to defeat Sunni Muslim insurgents and assume responsibility for keeping the peace, have been infiltrated by sectarian militias and are plagued by incompetence and corruption. Sounds like an old report, but it's filed this week by McClatchy newspapers. 2 weeks with American units that patrolled with Iraqi forces found that Iraqi officers sold new uniforms meant for their troops and that their soldiers wore plastic shower sandals while manning checkpoints, abused prisoners, and solicited bribes to free suspects they'd captured. This is in the last few weeks. What is the guy who was Iraqi prime minister when the all the purple fingers erupted last year? Think? Ibrahim Jafari is in Iran now. Isn't that wild? He's of the Islamic Dawah Party. He was the prime minister at the time of the elections last year. He says U.S. troops should leave now. Concerning occupying forces in Iraq, he said the best way for them... That's the wording of the Iranian source that's reporting this. Jafari said the best way for them to is leaving Iraq. Even public opinion, he said, in their own country supports their departure from Iraq. He also congratulated his Iranian hosts on the 28th anniversary of the 1979 revolution. So they're pals. And even though George Bush looked in his eyes and saw his heart and was good, Russian President Putin now says the new U.S. strategy will work in Iraq only if a date for withdrawing the troops is set. Seems to me the date for the withdrawal of foreign forces should be set. It won't work if we don't decide beforehand when the foreign contingents should be withdrawn. People should know that they have to be prepared to take on full responsibility inside the country by a certain date, says Putin. Pooty Poot, who also has been quoted, I think, in other media in this country as saying nasty stuff about the current American foreign policy. And finally, news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, like many of it, let's see, Dateline Baghdad, Reuters reports, anecdotal evidence, including interviews with arms dealers, suggests that many policemen are selling the highly prized Glock pistol on the black market. Already a shopper's delight for buyers with enough cash. Everything from the ubiquitous AK-47 assault rifle to rocket-propelled grenade launchers, sniper rifles, and belt-fed medium machine guns are available on the black market. Coming from Iran? No. Many looted from the huge Iraqi arms dumps that the U.S. Army failed to secure immediately following the invasion. A 2006 report by the Brookings Institution said the flow of weapons from the Iraqi forces, Iraq's own armed forces, into the black market and into the hands of militias had left U.S. commanders facing a dilemma. They had to choose between properly equipping Iraqi security forces and risk seeing the equipment disappear or giving them lower quality equipment that would deprive them of the wherewithal to succeed. These violations were big and alarming, Iraqi government spokesman Ali al-Daba told Reuters. I'm not saying it's not still happening, he said, but it's getting less. Iraqi police and soldiers seize weapons in routine raids and then sell them to weapons dealers, says an arms dealer. Some policemen also come to me, he adds, and offer to sell their Glocks, claiming they have some problems and urgently need money. Many of Baghdad's residents are arming themselves against the violence, so they're buying AKs and Glocks. So we are making Iraq more like the United States. Don't you know? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast.
Should you weep and mourn? Look up, look up. Just Well, sir, it's been a quiet week in Lake Reverie, Minnesota, my hometown. Trudy Ingebrigtsen down at the Save a Penny was dealing with a great existential question of her life as a small-town retailer. Namely, is it ethical to extend a January white sale into the first week of February? See, Trudy's a God-fearing Lutheran girl. Oh, she'd be pleased as punch to hear herself described as a girl. But ever since she started working in the Save a Penny as a 16-year-old, putting what they used to call notions on the proper shelves, Trudy's been fascinated, you might even say obsessed, with ethics of retailing. And how early should you put up the Christmas decorations? How long do you keep the clearance sale prices at 50% off before you admit defeat and go down to 70% off? Is it fair to put the candies and the cigarettes and the junkie magazines right next to the cash register? Trudy actually consulted Father Carl on these questions, and he told her, well, you are supposed to be your brother's keeper. But nowhere is it written that you have to be your brother's crap cop. So, like every other member of the retail fraternity, Trudy puts up the Christmas decorations a few days earlier every year, and she puts the tempting nuisance items at the ultimate impulse point. But she doesn't wait more than 2 weeks before going down to the final discount. She feels comfortable with those decisions, Trudy does. But Father Carl's wisdom really wasn't helping her with the question of how long to keep the white sale going. So she was sitting at the counter of the Catbox Cafe waiting for Katie Youngston to come in for her 10 o'clock coffee. Maybe they could talk about it. Katie had raised two strong sons by herself after that year when Alf Youngston went off on an ice fishing trip. It was back in 1989, and he never came back. Both of her sons, Steve and Stan, were working with Katie now at her real estate office, and they were learning the first lesson of selling real estate in Lake Reverie, which was always bring in plenty of reading material to the office in the morning. Katie finally arrived at the counter of the Catbox Cafe about 10 minutes late, which up in our neck of the woods is considered very late indeed. Matter of fact, young Johnny Sarnquist once showed up 20 minutes late for his Aunt Sonia's potluck supper. All that was left was the pots, a couple of the serving spoons. We're very punctual people, don't you know? Big Mike Arnstead, who knows how to fix every kind of car except the Swedish one, says he doesn't wear a watch since he moved from Hibbing to Lake Reverie. Says you know what time it is by where everybody you know is in their daily routine. So Trudy was relieved when Katie finally breezed in, almost waltzing over to the counter with her excitement and swinging her bag full of home tour videotapes like a schoolgirl. "It's Dick Yinkle," Katie whispered as Helen Nyquist started brewing a fresh pot of decaf. "He's coming to town." Trudy had two thoughts right away. The first one was she was going to definitely extend the white sale another week. And the second one was, why was Dick Yinkle coming to Lake Reverie? He was the most famous liberal talk radio host in the country, he was. Of course, Trudy mulled it over. She was hard-pressed to come up with the name of the second most famous liberal talk radio host in the country. But still, she said, as Katie nibbled dubiously on her 7-grain muffin, Katie was on the fourth year of her diet, and it was getting old. Still, Trudy said, what would bring Dick Yinkle here? Katie smiled as if she'd just been given the combination to the safe at the First Siemens Bank. He's coming to buy a house. Katie gave Trudy that I've just told you something you shouldn't know look. And Trudy just sipped her postum. Trudy Ingebretson might just well be the last person in the entire upper Midwest to drink postum. But Ella always stocked it for her just the same. You know he's running for the Senate, Katie finally continued after giving up on getting a rise out of Trudy. And he's got to have a residence somewhere in the state, and he's coming here for the announcement of his candidacy, so, you know, you just put two and two together. And at that point, Ella came over with Katie's decaf, and Ella finished Katie's sentence for her. You just put two and two together, and you get too many. Well, sir, after the laughter subsided, the check got split. Trudy went back to the Save a Penny to tell her young assistant, Ollie Linkston, to change the prices on the bedspreads back to the low ones. And Katie took her bag full of house tour videos over to the big announcement event scheduled for noon. It's not as if Lave Reverie had never been the scene of a celebrity political sighting. I mean, 6 years ago, when the bald-headed wrestler with the deep voice was running for governor, he'd stopped at Don Sturdivant's bait shop, bought himself a bucket of bait, then made the evening newscasts all over the state by eating a half bucket full of the creatures washed down with a bottle of the local spring water. Mr. Sarnquist, Johnny's dad, had put the story in a photograph on the front page of the Lake Reverie weekly newspaper, The Bugle. The paper's slogan, you could see it under the title, written in the great old-fashioned type that the big newspapers use for their names. The slogan was, "It only blows on Friday." But Dick Yankel was a whole other type of character, unlike the wrestler, who arrived downtown in a stretch Hummer, accompanied by what his press agent fellow referred to as a passel of gal pals. Dick Yankel's arrival right in the parking space in front of First Siemens Bank was as progressive as a feminist rodeo. Dick arrived in a Prius, a car nobody in Lake Reverie had ever seen, and most of the folks in town had never even heard of it. Gus Jornstein said the name sounded like a skin condition his calves were prone to. When Dick got out of the Prius, there was a crowd of folks, most of whom had come in from Mankato on a couple of buses organized by the Mankato Liberal Talk radio station, the station that, right after Dick Yankel, featured a host who used to be a born-again Christian but went through 3 weeks of therapy and was now completely homosexual. Some Grateful Dead music started playing through a loudspeaker mounted on top of the car, powered by the solar panel the speaker was setting on. Dick walked over to Arnie Yarlson's snack wagon, parked on the boundary of Lonesome Farmer's Square. He shook Arnie's hand for the cameras for the TV stations in Minneapolis and Duluth. And then when the camera crew started packing up and relocating for the big speech indoors, Dick asked Arnie if he had any brisket sandwiches. Arnie looked a little sheepish. He didn't want the big talk radio host to think he'd never had a Jewish customer before. Arnie remembered Mr. Rothstein, a Polish dentist, who'd spent 5 years in Lake Reverie before leaving for the Twin Cities. And just before leaving, when Trudy Ingebretson asked him why he was going away, he looked at her with an even sadder expression than he usually wore. He just said, "I don't think God meant for man to eat frozen bagels." Well, Dick never got his brisket sandwich. By the time he ambled onto the stage in the school auditorium with the logos of the Catbox Cafe and the Bugle and Don's bait shop and antique alley glued onto the banner that hung over the stage. Dick was beginning to wonder just how progressive Lake Reverie was. As even for a guy from Hibbing, it just wasn't easy to figure out the political agenda behind the T-shirt Ella and three of her friends were wearing to the big speech. It said, "Sport to troops, send Ludovisk." Dick started off his remarks in his usual hard-hitting style, allowing as how Rush Limbaugh was too fat to run for the Senate, and Sean Hannity was too dumb. Then he said that although a lot of folks criticize him for a lack of experience, he really has a lot of experience that would help prepare him to be part of the U.S. government, because his last 2 years at the Liberal Talk Radio Network had taught him what it's like to work for a bankrupt organization. But really, Dick Yankel's announcement speech was more emotional than the folks in town expected. His campaign had flown Ronnie Yang up to Lake Reverie from his home in upstate New York. Ronnie and Dick had met at North Hibbing High School. They'd been a comedy team in the 11th and 12th grades, a team of Yankel and Yang. And when Dick went off to college at the big fancy school back east, Ronnie had moved to the same town and worked in the 7-Eleven just to be near Dick. Now, Nick was hugging him, the first time they'd seen each other since Ronnie was fired off the big comedy show they'd both worked at. When Dick felt too guilty to call Ronnie and say goodbye, he just sent his old partner all of his audiophile pressings of Grateful Dead LPs and a pound of very high-grade marijuana. Well, that was the story Dick told from the stage after hugging Ronnie, all except the part about the pound. And Ronnie, who had tears in his eyes, said that Dick was a really great straight man and he would be a really great senator. And then Dick said, "You were the straight man." And then the sound engineer put on a live recording of Sugar Magnolia, and the folks from Mankato started clapping until the bus driver signaled it was time for them to leave. Katie made her way through the crowd to the backstage area, which was actually set up at the spot where Lonesome Farmer's Square gave way to the parking lot for what used to be Tom Venstead's feed store, till he sold out to the MaxMart people. And now it's a much bigger parking lot for a MaxMart store that's just one bank loan away from opening, which of course would have been the biggest event in town up to and not including the moment when Dick Yankel bought one of Katie's houses. So Katie's making her way backstage. She's walking past the bloggers' table, the video bloggers' tent, the podcasters' midway, and the real estate for half a dozen other types of members of the universe that Katie had only vaguely heard about. She's making her way through the grassroots apparatus of the modern progressive political campaign. And as she's doing so, Katie's going through the home tour videos in her head. She's trying to prioritize which would be the best resonance for Dick to use as his Minnesota base in the upcoming campaign. The Victorian on West 3rd just looked a little too precious for a man of the people, even if his yearly salary allowed him to buy a few dozen of the people. The sturdy two-story wood frame pile on Duluth Street, Katie thought that was a definite contender, although she realized it might be a little too fixer-upper for someone like Dick, if not for Dick himself. She didn't even know if the candidate had to live in his residence, as long as he paid his taxes from that address. But she thought those were the kind of questions that could be settled while the checks were clearing. So she gets back to what the hand letters sign identified as the talent holding room. And now Katie's got all her ducks in a row. And in old Norwegian widow honesty, she thought they might just be the best-looking ducks in the county. And just as she was savoring that thought and wondering about how big an ad she should buy in the Bugle to announce the sale, Dick Yickel came through the talent-holding room door. He was sweating. Katie had never seen him sweat, not on the big-time comedy show, where an ordinary fellow might have started perspiring about the time when silence in the audience passed the two-minute mark. And not on his book tours, and definitely not tonight, even when he was answering the question from the St. Paul TV reporter about drug use by saying that one thing he was good at was inhaling. But now he was sweating. Katie thought he was grasping the plastic 1 liter bottle of Croatian spring water the way she'd always seen celebrities holding bottles of spring water, as if they were getting pure, unfiltered life source just by holding the water, even with a plastic bottle in the way. Dick was giggling, walking quickly along with a young girl assistant who was, it seemed to Katie, she was struggling to keep pace with Dick and to take notes of what he was saying when he wasn't giggling. Katie figured she had about 2.5 seconds of what they call in politics face time with the newly minted candidate. And she walked up to Dick Yinkle and she said, "Mr. Yinkle, we're so happy to have you in Lake Reverie." And as she started to hand him the bag full of home tour videos, he redirected the bag in a gesture as smooth and as practiced as a magician plucking a rose out of his sleeve. He just slid it on over to his assistant, and he looked straight on at Katie, and he said words that she's never going to forget. He said, "Hey, cool. Thanks for coming." And before Katie could even mention the splendid mock tour on Sturtevant Place, which she'd realized was the perfect headquarters for a candidate with its wood-burning fireplace and its high-speed internet access and all, Dick Yinkle was back in his Prius, burning a heck of a lot of alternative fuel in his eagerness to get back to the Twin Cities before midnight. Well, the next morning, Katie was waiting for Trudy at the Catbox Cafe. And over her cup of decaf, Katie told Trudy the pretty unvarnished version of her encounter with the candidate and how she never really got to sell him a house per se, but how maybe if she got his email address, he or one of his people could take the house tours online. And Trudy sipped silently on her postum. And she thought to herself, this is a sign. This is the Lord telling me that it's okay to raise the prices on the white goods back up to normal. That's the news from Lake Reverie, Minnesota, where everyone is like you and me, except they're more like you. Thank you very much.
She loved me fine when I was riding from Hong Kong, and she dug it even better calling long distance on the phone, and cool and sexy getting that postcard from Brazil. Oh, but now I'm back home. All she'll want to give is the chill. She said, "Oh, will you get back? We're more cha-cha all night long." But she lied. She said, "Oh, will you get back? We're gonna sing a different song." But she lied.
ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Daily London, Tony Blair admits that the family of the friendly fire victim of U.S. troops, Lance Corporal Matty Hull, had suffered further distress because of the delay in the inquest into the cause of his death. The U.S. Air Squadron this week apologized for the incident. The spokesman for the Idaho National Guard said, quote, "We're obviously very, very sorry for the family and extend our sympathies to them." Blair said he and the government regretted the postponement of the inquest, created largely by delay on the part of the Americans in providing video footage to the coroner. That's the video footage that a British tabloid got a leaked copy of last week that brought this back into the news. Dateline New York, Schools Chancellor Joel Klein. This is from a publication I didn't know existed called Flatbush Life. Yeah, baby. Joel Klein visited an East Flatbush public school to issue an apology to parents and school children who've been inconvenienced by recent changes to the City Department of Education's bus procedures. "We didn't do everything right, and I apologize for that," Klein told a packed crowd, like there's any of the kind in New York. During the Super Bowl this year, Kevin Federline was in a commercial playing a fast food worker. Quote, "The commercial is completely intended for me making fun of myself and my own situation. It has nothing to do with anybody in the fast food industry at all. So, you know, if we've offended anybody, I'm really sorry about that." And if you're asking who Kevin Federline is, you haven't been watching enough Anna Nicole Smith coverage. Deadline Washington, congressional frustration with the pace of Gulf Coast hurricane recovery exploded this week, with one lawmaker calling Louisiana's road home housing program a joke. Chairman of the committee, Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, went so far as to issue an apology to the citizens of Louisiana and Mississippi for what he called a, quote, "complete failure of the administration here in Washington to respond to the crisis," unquote. The minister of a Baptist church in South Portland, I believe this is Oregon, asked for forgiveness this week for frightening members of the Jewish community with a provocative newspaper ad that promoted his Sunday sermon about anti-Semitism. The ad for the First Baptist Church touted a sermon titled, quote, "The Only Way to Destroy the Jewish Race," unquote. The sermon was supportive of Jews, but the words in the ad generated fear and anger, as well as complaints to the church and the newspaper. "Dear friends, please forgive me for causing alarm in your hearts," the Reverend Philip Andrukaitis. Andrukaitis wrote in a statement released Monday afternoon. "No doubt several folks have already jumped to conclusions about me and this church." And the Portland Press Herald, Portland, Maine, Sunday Telegram apologized to all who might have been offended by this unintentional oversight. "Additional safeguards have been put in place to avoid a similar situation in the future." That's what this world needs, ladies and gentlemen, more safeguards. Dateline Mineola, New York, five students sued a college over its treatment of a student video that mimics a Middle Eastern hostage-taking. A video the students described as a joke, but the college saw as insensitive. The lawsuit came as the students apologized but demanded their jobs back. They were stripped of residence hall duties for making the video. Republican congressman's outrage over the imprisonment of two Border Patrol agents from Texas intensified Wednesday. That's kind of a Lou Dobbs story, as the top Homeland Security investigative official apologized for his aide's misleading statements to lawmakers about the case. The agents were sent to federal prison for wounding a fleeing Mexican drug trafficker and hiding evidence. Never told investigators that they went on patrol intending to, quote, "shoot a Mexican," admitted the inspector general of the Department of Homeland Security. Never did that, apparently. The misstatements occurred when aides briefed four Texas congressmen about the shooting near an area southeast of El Paso. "It was an unfortunate mischaracterization," the inspector general told a congressman from Austin. "I apologize on behalf of our staff and just want to make perfectly clear this was not intentional." Simon Cowell apologized for starting an American Idol press conference 40 minutes late. Deadline London, the director of a revamped Lord of the Rings musical went to J.R.R. Tolkien's grave to seek the author's posthumous blessing for staging the cult classic, and he apologized in case the writer disapproved. That was a magical moment, director Matthew Warkas told reporters when presenting to the press the 50-strong cast of what's being billed as the most expensive musical ever in London. I visited his grave in Oxford to apologize and get his seal of approval. I apologized in case he didn't like the idea of a stage show. That's good advice for anybody else who might be listening, planning a stage show. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyright feature of this broadcast. Oh, just one more item of interest. Pakistani authorities under President Parvez, however you pronounce it, Musharraf, have failed to tackle abuses of human rights in the country and have presided over a collapse of protection mechanisms. That from a leading human rights organization in Islamabad. But he's our friend. How could that be? Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, available in both Sirius and XM satellite radios. You don't have to choose. On 133 on XM satellite radio and I think channel 105 on Sirius satellite radio. You got another satellite radio network? We'll be there. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/the show. Available wherever you want it. On your computer at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like me appearing on the Craig Ferguson Show Tuesday night to plug my book in the hope that you might get around to buying it. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much.
Buy the book.
Thank you, President Bush. The email address for this broadcast is, it's called Not Enough Indians. Thank you for asking. The email, it was on the bestseller list on the LA Dog Trainer. And they didn't correct that. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks. And Bob and Jenny here at WWNO in New Orleans for helping to make today's program possible. Or impossible, depending on how you look at it. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans. Anderson, that's the way we pronounce it.